you're asking what radical climate action looks like, and this is it. Just really think there's this like, you have to vote for a president and then hope that they do something about climate change. And it's like, that's just not working because we're not going to get things done unless people learn what the solutions are and how we get there.
And welcome to the Politics Girl podcast. I'm your host, Lee McGowan. Let's get into it. When we start talking about the climate and environmentalism, we can very quickly arrive at a place of doom and gloom. Recently, people have been talking about rebranding climate change as climate rescue, so it feels more proactive and hopeful rather than something we're just passively watching happen. One of the best rebranders of climate catastrophe to climate action is today's guest, Sage Linear. Sage Linear is a climate activist, public speaker, and content creator who was recently honored by Time magazine as one of the 10 next generation leaders. Probably most well known for creating a student-led class on solutions for a sustainable and just future while an undergrad at UC Berkeley, Sage's class enrolled over 2,000 students with the overall goal of offering a vision of what better future could look like. Sustainable and Just Future is now a nonprofit aimed at bringing the solutions course to universities around the world. Sage's work has been featured on New York Times, Forbes, the World's Economic Forum, and Vogue, and she has spoken at conferences, universities, and organizations around the world. So without further ado, please welcome my guest, climate activist, public speaker, and executive director of Sustainable and Just Future, Sage Linear. Welcome, Sage.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining me. I've been such a big fan of yours from a distance ever since you started that class at Berkeley. I loved that as a student, you looked around and you were like, there's something missing here. And you filled the space yourself instead of waiting for someone else to do it. I also love the idea that you pushed back on like kind of this old way of thinking, which is either to pretend there's not a problem or just overwhelm us by telling us how bad the problem is. And you chose to reframe it around solutions. And I think that's an essential way of looking at the world.
The solutions-oriented narrative, I think I'm really trying to fill the gap of we can't solve problems we don't understand, and your average person is still not getting, like, they still don't understand what the next steps are for getting ourselves out of the entire ecological problem. And I think a lot of people haven't even heard of, like, what problems we're facing in the food system and things like that. It's not just climate. And so I'm really trying to like bring those monsters out of the dark, and then also position people with realistic pathways towards, you know, solving things, building a better world, and the roles that they can play in their career and their community to address these things.
Yeah, I totally get that. It's exactly what I try and do with democracy. I always say, like, you can't fix something you don't understand. We are deliberately not taught civics in school. We're deliberately not taught how the government works. And then we're like, how come the government doesn't work for us? You're like, because it's a broken system that we need to pay more attention to. And often, when you don't understand something, you check out, right? Like, it's when you learn a new word and suddenly you're like, is everyone using this word now? Like, why is everyone using plethora? And you're like, it's not. It's just that you now understand the word so you can hear it. And once you understand something, it's so much easier to solve it. I mean, you've been quoted saying that this ecological crisis is usually talked about in a way that it's all too late, that there's nothing we can do. Humanity is like fundamentally doomed. And then where do you go from there, right? That's a pretty demoralizing worldview. And it's hard to get people together to try and do anything if they feel like the cause is hopeless. So this idea of looking for solutions, of, you know, saying it's pointless just to sit around and wait for someone to give us the tools we need to go out and find those tools ourselves and then use those tools.
I understand the climate anxiety because in a lot of ways, the cards have been dealt. Like, we are living in a climate changed world. The climate is never going to come back. And we're locked into a certain amount of warming that is going to disrupt life as we know it. But that being said, we are not looking at, there's no scenario that we're looking at right now that means total human extinction. So if we just all like throw up our hands and like cover our eyes and go like, well, ignorance is bliss. Like, I'm just going to enjoy things while I can. We're just setting our descendants up to be worse and worse off, because there's going to be billions of people on this planet in 2100, in 2500, and we don't know how many billions, but the decisions that we make today can be the deciding factor as to whether or not they are equipped to survive, to adapt. You know, there's still going to be weddings, there's still going to be school, there's still going to be cultures. And we have to figure out how to, you know, help them live relatively uninterrupted lives as, you know, homelands get lost and crops fail and things like that. We need to develop resilient and flexible systems that enable life to keep going on.
Like you said, most of us, especially if you're young, you had very little to do with how destroyed the world is at this point. And it's hard to feel like, okay, well, I didn't cause this problem. And now you're telling me there's nothing I can do about this problem. I missed the beginning. And now you're telling me I missed the end. And I think, right, that lack of power makes people feel hopeless and a bit helpless. Like you're like, okay, well, now what are we supposed to do, right? And if you're a young person, as you've said, and you get this doomsday message, this what's the point message of anything, then it's like, well, what's the point of planning for my future if there isn't going to be one? What's the point of like doing school if I'm not going to be like, if I'm not going to live on a hospitable planet? I often
what's
feel
the point
like
of saving
that.
For retirement?
Right. What's the point? Sometimes I feel like I'm like, what are we even doing here? This is like a disaster. Right. And I often feel like that raising my own son. Right. Like, I have no idea what the economy of the future is going to look like, what the jobs of the future are going to look like. Like, what should he be training for if we don't even know? Like, AI now, I'm like, well, what am I supposed to tell him to learn if this is the way it's supposed to be? And then you start talking about, like, will our air be breathable? Will we have enough water? You know, this year we're talking about, like, will we have American democracy? And the whole thing can make people feel immobilized. It's fascinating that the way you've come at this work, because you said it, you came at environmentalism from sort of a social justice background, because it kind of encapsulated all the things you cared about, because you said there's no human rights on a dead planet. And I think that's so exactly right, right? Like, we have to say, okay, this is already happening. So now what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, I think that's a point a lot of people miss. We, as much as I do believe that polar bears and sea turtles have intrinsic value and matter, and as well, like, you can make an argument that, like, all living things are codependent, and as humans, we're not capable of surviving without ecosystems. They're how we feed ourselves, they're how we get clean water, that's how we get clean air. So when we destroy ecosystems, we also destroy ourselves. But I think most folks don't understand yet that climate action is inherently a human rights fight, and that climate change will exacerbate every existing system of inequality. So, you know, if you care about feminism or racial justice or, you know, labor, you should care about climate as well, because it's all very much connected.
I heard somebody say the other day, it's like, don't think of it as saving the planet, where we have to think of it as saving humanity, because the planet will ultimately be fine. We kill ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
The planet's been here for billions of years. It's going to be like, okay, cool, let's shake those humans off and we're going to start again. You know, like, it's been hit
another
by
another mass extinction. Like, what's
yeah,
one
like,
more?
Okay, what's one more? Like, we could be gone and the planet will still be there. So we have to look at it like saving humanity. Or, you know, I think that's a really smart way of saying it. We're looking at a population of 10 billion maybe by 2050. That's something we have to plan for. Like, where are all those people going to go? How do we feed them? How do we organize the systems? How do we make it fair and just? If we have a planet that's constantly warming and we say to the people of India, oh, sorry, your country has become completely inhospitable. It's too hot for people to function here. There's going to be mass migrations north, and
right,
people are already unhappy with migrations, mass migrations, right? So we have to sort of plan for these things. You've said it beautifully. Even if it was possible to flip a switch tomorrow and the whole world was run by renewable energy, we would still be in an ecological crisis, because we still have pollution. We still have deforestation. We still have over-extraction. So what we really need is, I think you mentioned it earlier, this sort of radically different system. And I wholeheartedly agree with that sentiment. But can you tell me what you mean when you say a radically different system?
Yes. Okay. The listeners are like, yo, okay, I get it. Let's get into the solutions.
Let's do it.
So I always say that trying to solve climate change is like trying to cure a cough when you have bronchitis. You're just getting at one symptom of the problem, and you can't solve it that way. This has been for so long, and I'm writing a speech right now that I'm giving next week that I'm going to say something like this. So if you guys see this on social media later, I'm going to say that.
We're workshopping saying the speech.
This has been for so long positioned as like fossil fuels v. renewable energy, but that's just not it at all. Fossil fuels are the how we got to climate change, not the why. But there's a profit incentive for extraction. There's a profit incentive for burning fossil fuels and for overextracting resources. So we're at a triple nexus, which is climate change, over pollution, and or pollution and over extraction of resources. And so all three of those crises can only be solved with an economic transformation. So what that means is we have to deprioritize economic growth, GDP, like the economy has to ideally stop growing or slow growing. There's different ways of looking at it. You can look at post-growth economics or degrowth. But unless we can find some way, and like European countries allegedly, I can get into that. I can get into that. Unless we can find some way to decouple GDP from ecosystem devastation, which you just can't, we have to challenge like eternal growth as an inevitable and as a good thing, because the economy has grown 5 times in the last 3 decades, I believe. 5 times larger than it was 3 decades ago, but it's been accompanied by the degradation of 98% of the world's ecosystems. And so people are like, okay, cool, how do you do that? And so the more basic level version of that, or the more understandable, is a transition from a linear economy to a circular economy. So right now, our economic system is based on extracting resources from nature. We mine metals, we cut down trees, we pull fish out of the ocean, whatever it is. Turning those resources into like concentrated versions of themselves. So you process the trees into paper or lumber or whatever it is. You smelt the ores, whatever the mine, whatever it is. Sending those all around the world to be like put into products in the supply chain. And so it might be assembled in China, but it might have components from 16 countries all around the world. And then you ship it to the global north, Western countries typically, and we use whatever little resource it is, we throw it away really quickly, and then we start that start cycle of extraction all over again. And this is how we've been able to speed up the economy and grow the economy over the past few decades. And this is also the root cause of the ecological crisis. This is where climate change comes from. If you look at the supply chain more in depth, you can find that between 65 and 72% of global emissions are associated with the production of household goods. People don't like, I think there's this huge mental disconnect, and especially in America and Western countries, where people are like, well, corporations are the problem. Well, capitalism is the problem. Yes, and yes. But who do the corporations serve? Yes, there is a 1%, don't get me wrong, and they hold a outsized amount of power. But also the American people hold an outsized amount of power, like Amazon and Target and Sephora and all of these like consumer good industries. Even you can look at individual companies, you can look at like the tech industry, and you look at like Apple and the consumption of the Apple Watch and the iPad and the iPhone and the MacBook and the AirPods, and we got all this tech. And it's all because all of this is happening because there's a profit incentive, largely because this global middle class and global upper middle class are providing the profit incentive. And it's when you really look into like why climate change is happening, why there's too many resources being extracted, it is for consumption. Nobody's doing it like just for funsies. Like we're not just burning fossil fuels just for funsies. And so I think this like fossil fuels v renewable energy framing is selling us way, like we have been institutionally lied to by that framing, because it positions us to be like, oh, well, I just really hope that Joe Biden installs more solar panels because that's the only way. And the fact of the matter is, we know that we cannot transition to renewable energy fast enough to avoid going over 2 degrees Celsius. And so we're going to have to use less energy. So we need to look at what that economic transition looks like. So yeah, that's kind of like a very high level overview. And I know a lot of people have like a lot of like, buh, 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 buh. But what I want to really hone in on is like, you're asking what radical climate action looks like. And this is it. It is, we just cannot build enough renewable energy capacity fast enough. So if you really want to adequately address climate change, we have to challenge growth. And we have to shrink consumer industries. We have to move towards more of a secondhand economy. We have to move towards an economy that's more based on services and experiences than goods. Shopping is an American hobby, and it shouldn't be. There's so many other things that would make our communities better, that would make us happier, that could be our like, our hobbies, our go-tos. literally just trade out shopping for like sports, for dance, for art, for, you know, anything that involves, you know, community, and you're not like, it's not really like heavily entrenched in the sale of goods in that way. So all these things are interconnected, and we have to have this economic transition. We have to challenge this theory of growth in order to adequately address climate change and the triple nexus of pollution, overconsumption, and climate change.
And are you finding that there are people who are open-minded to that? Because you've said one of the answers is we need regional and local changes to sort of be tailored to each individual community's needs. Can you talk me through that to see if how, you know, we at home could be doing it?
Well, you know, you can definitely buy less from Target, and you can critically evaluate what it is that you actually need versus what you're being influenced to buy, what you're buying because you're bored, what you're buying to manage your emotions, like, you know. And
I was going to say, what,
like,
you're buying because you're sad. I think,
right,
you go to any
of these like financial literacy books, and they're like, why are you $40,000 in credit card debt? Let's talk about your feelings. And it's great because in trying to save the planet, you actually save so much money because you don't buy things. You asked two questions. You asked how receptive people are to this message. It depends. And there is a huge subset of people, especially people in power, who absolutely don't want to hear this message and absolutely don't want this to be true. I think as I get more so invited onto like a global stage and into rooms of power, like I'm trying to have this conversation with people. And I think, I guess where we meet in the middle is just like, you know, but there is still an economic opportunity as we transition into a more circular economy. There's like $1 trillion+ opportunity in renewable energy that's still there. We still need renewable energy build out. And there's also a lot of industries and companies that I want to see grow. We need more plant-based meat alternatives. We need more like biomaterials, because I don't think a lot of people are aware of it, but like plastic is a petrochemical. Plastic is a petroleum derivative. And not just plastic. Most household products in the world at this point are like the paint on your walls and the chair that you're sitting on, and maybe even the shirt that you're wearing, are all derived from petroleum. So unless it's like 100% cotton, you know, unless you've got like plain wood on the walls.
Yeah. And so like hemp furniture.
Right. So we need bio alternatives. Those are a lot of companies that I want to see grow. So there is still an opportunity for growth in some ways. And there is still huge, huge opportunity for innovation. And so I want people to feel like there's things to be excited about. There's industries to grow. There's the ability to like meet needs creatively. The secondhand economy really needs to grow. Like any innovation that makes it easier, any type of app or service that makes it easier for people to shop secondhand on everything, tech, clothes, furniture, I'm all for it. Like those are so sexy. Want to see more of them. Love it. And so that kind of leads me into your second question is like, how do we localize this? How do we regionalize this? So one of the largest issues I see in why we're in this crisis is, I'm not going to say it's globalization. I'm going to say it's homogeneity. That's the term. If you take America, for example, or honestly, increasingly the world, you have like one culture from California to New York and from top to bottom. You've got one culture. You've got one way of dressing. We all eat the same 10 fruits. We all eat the same 10 vegetables. We all eat the same Kellogg cereal. And we've created this homogeneity, and it ignores ecosystems. It ignores regionality. And so what we need to see is actually, I would love to see more culture and more diversity. And, you know, like in the United States, there's so much we could do to empower and revive indigenous food systems and eat the food that's native to this place. Because, you know, we have this huge globalized food system. The average American meal contains ingredients from 5 countries. And those monocrop, I'm not going to get into the food systems right now, but basically growing so much of the same 10 fruits and the same 10 vegetables is actually really bad for the planet. We need a much larger diversity in the foods that we eat and things like that. So,
and we're talking about things like the amount of cows we have for beef, and the amount of corn we make for corn syrup that we put into everything, or that we feed the cows, that kind of thing.
But also, even the expectation that you're going to be able to eat a tomato 365 days a year. They're not always in season.
That's why strawberries are bad now. When you eat them, you're like, this is not actually in season. And I'm eating this weird grown fruit that is white in the middle.
Right. And it is either like grown in a greenhouse in Mexico, or they might be like, we're getting kiwis from New Zealand now in the United States. Like, that is crazy. And so now you can have kiwis all year long, but like, that's unsustainable. So we need more seasonality and regionality. And that's an example of like how we have to transform the food system. But on the local level, like there is this opportunity to divest from major corporations in creating a secondhand economy, in creating a more local culture, in creating more sense of community, where we're not the TikTok, like, run, don't walk to Target thing, like, it's gotta go. And there's so much opportunity to create reuse of materials, reuse of, like I said, furniture, tech, clothes, whatever it is, on a local level, and keep materials in the economy on the local level instead of going to landfill and importing all this stuff from, you know, Bangladesh and India and China that's been manufactured abroad. So we do need to slow down systems of production. And in order to do that, we have to make use of what we already have. And a lot of that can happen on the local level. But also, and I'm going to cut myself short because I've been talking for a long time. localized adaptation to climate is another part of what we need to look at. So how are we going to start adapting to, you know, if this area is going to be more prone to drought, and this area is going to be more prone, well, drought is also likely prone to fires, and this place is likely going to flood. Like, we need to actually start talking about emergency response a lot more, because I don't think we are still.
No, we're very reactionary. We're like, oh my God, it's flooding again. Well, how did this happen? Right. And you're like, well, right, it happened last year and the year before, and it's only going up. You know, if you're in Florida, you're on the coast over there, it would, like, they're having so much flooding, and then we in California have so much trouble with the fires and the droughts, and yeah, so it's
and
all.
And there's
regional.
Massive mudslides in LA, right, a couple months ago, and right, people lost their homes, and like, people are still like, huh? Like, what? Like, once in a lifetime, like, once in a lifetime large fires. Yeah, no, that happened 2-3 years ago. So we need to, you know, so there's a lot that can be done on that regional level to become more self-sufficient, more less dependent on global supply chains, less dependent on these global, on these massive, like, global corporations. Because I think everyone is looking for, like, I think there's just a lot of, like, pointing fingers in a circle where it's like, it's the billionaire. And don't get me wrong, it totally is. It totally is. It totally is billionaires. But, like, Jeff got rich because of Amazon.
Yeah. And, like, because we love Amazon. You know, Jeff got rich because, right, we love Amazon. Yeah.
Right. And people just won't connect the dots. They won't take accountability. They're like, well, my Amazon order doesn't make a difference. And I'm like, yes, beloved, but all 330 million.
I get that. And I love my Amazon. And I'm telling you, I get that. I mean, I think you said the words earlier about being flexible and resilient. You know, like, collectively, we have to work towards this mindset of not only getting organized regionally and locally and sort of seeing a bigger picture, but this concept of being flexible and resilient, I think, is often missed. We're going to have to change a little bit. You're going to have to change a little bit. We might not get everything we want the first time around. And that's not just an environmentalist thing. That's an every issue thing, right? We have to keep coming back to the table and trying again, or we have to take part of the win and then adjust our expectations and then move forward and come back for the rest. And I think that concept of flexibility and resilience is so essential.
Yeah. In terms of flexibility, I typically mean, like, the reality is that we're losing seasons, and we're losing the ability to have an expectation of what, you know, next year is going to look like. I'm just not growing up in the same world. If for a handful of generations, there was this, like, typical for people in the Western world, it was like, you're going to do this, and then your next life milestone will be that, and then you'll do this, and then if you do a good job, you're going to get vacations, and you can go to the tropics, and that sort of thing. And so flexibility means, like, we really don't know what the next year is going to look like. We don't know if my town will be, like, the town that you're going to high school in, if you're 15 years old now, you don't know if the high school will be there next year. And I think we have to reframe this for ourselves so that we aren't shocked and devastated, so that we're not like, oh my God, I've lost everything. I think also meant on a mental level, on a spiritual level, becoming less attached to your stuff and your belongings and that kind of thing, and just prioritizing what really matters. You know, me and my family made it out of that, you know, that horrific flood, and we have everyone and we're safe, rather than like, oh my God, I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on all the things in my house and it's gone. That's, you know, I think that's part of it. So talking about like the mental resilience that we need in order for climate change, in addition to infrastructural changes, funding changes, and again, on the local level, like we can accomplish so much of climate action on the regional level and should. We should not be waiting. Like, you know, wouldn't it be so slay if we had like a national train network? But we could start that by everybody working on their city council and their counties. Like, go to those meetings and bully people. Like, go tweet your city council members. And, you know, getting more funding for disaster recovery, things like that, is going to happen on the city level, on the county level. I think people are waiting for, again, I just really think there's this like, you have to vote for a president and then hope that they do something about climate change. And it's like, that's just not working. It's not happening. Joe Biden has been the most progressive president on climate change of US history. And I don't think that's a testament to Joe Biden. I think just like a testament to how much all the others have been like deeply vested
To
in.
how low the bar was.
Right. Like they were like, no, we want climate change. We love this idea and we're enthusiastically investing in it. And we have one president who's like, we're gonna enthusiastically invest in it a little less. And people are like, oh my God, we've been waiting for this.
Yeah, no, it's hard. And listen, I've been at the White House and I've talked to the climate people and they are passionate and they are young and they are putting together legislation and they're writing legislation, which I always think is so exciting when you meet legislators who are like fired up about how they wrote the bill because there's no loopholes that they can't just give money to Mississippi and then they can't use it for environmental causes. Like they're like, oh, we wrote this bill and they can't take the money unless they use it for water. You know, like they are so psyched and they're so positive. And that's what I always say to young people when they're like, Joe Biden's too old. I'm like, yeah, but the people around him aren't. They are so passionate and they're so into it. But I like the idea of what you're saying about how we can create change in our community, that if we're working at a community level, we can sort of patchwork out some sort of system change by creating change in our school districts, in our cities, in our counties, and then in our states. And then we can look to the president and be like, hey, you know, keep supporting EV vehicles instead of what Trump wants to do, which is take all money from EVs and put it in back into oil and gas and create apparently flying cars. That is his new plan. But I do
Oh,
think, oh
fun.
yeah, flying cars, that'll be just so terrific. It's exactly what we're ready for.
I like there's so many people who are working on this and doing a great job at the federal level. It's just one, it's too big of a beast to tackle at the federal level because this country is massive, right?
It's so big.
And two, it's they are up against so many hurdles, and unfortunately, anything they can get done is too little too late. So if they can only get 15% of the change done that we need, then that's up to us to get done the rest 85%.
I'm so excited that Politics Girl is now sponsored by Sundays for Dogs because I can legitimately tell you that my Chips loves it. If you haven't heard me go on about my golden doodle before, here I go. You guys, this dog, he is the best in the world. Now, he's been in a mood all week because he had to get shaved because of his mats, and he went from looking like Fozzie Bear to Dobby the house elf, so he is basically naked and in a bad mood. But that has not changed his appetite, and this dog loves Sundays for Dogs. He now rejects other food. It is both annoying and amazing. I ordered it all to my house, and I could not be happier. Sundays for Dogs is a fresh dog food made from a short list of human-grade ingredients. It was co-founded by a practicing veterinarian who tests and formulates every version of each recipe. Sundays contains 90% meat, 10% superfoods, and zero synthetic nutrients or artificial ingredients. And unlike other dog foods, Sundays doesn't require refrigeration or preparation because of their air-drying process, so you can just pour it and serve. This has been so easy. Chips likes the beef. He likes the chicken. I love that we change his food and what we pick up on walks doesn't change. It's all amazing. So if you and your dog want to go and try Sundays for Dogs, go to sundaysfordogs.com/politicsgirl to get 40% off your first order. That's sundaysfordogs.com/politicsgirl or use the code politicsgirl at checkout for 40% off. Because I'm sure your dog is just as special to you as my dog is to me. And don't these dogs deserve the best? Sundaysfordogs.com/politicsgirl. If I asked you how many subscriptions you have right now, would you be able to tell me? How about how much they cost? Most people think they could, and most people are wrong. In fact, 75% of people have subscriptions that they've completely forgotten about. 75%. It's amazing how much money these companies are making off us and we don't even know. That's why Rocket Money is so helpful. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It shows you all your subscriptions in one place, and if there's something you don't want or can no longer afford, Rocket Money can help you cancel it with just a few taps. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate for you to get a refund for the last couple of months of wasted money, and negotiate to lower your bills by up to 20%. All you have to do is take a picture of your bill and Rocket Money does the rest. It's a terrific service, which is probably why Rocket Money has over 5 million users and saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving its members up to $740 a year when using the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use and cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/politicsgirl. That's rocketmoney.com/politicsgirl. Did you know your temperature at night has one of the greatest impacts on the quality of your sleep? If you're one of those people who wakes up too hot or too cold, then I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made bedsheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics to make temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Miracle Made's silver-infused sheets are not only thermoregulating, but also prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times longer than other sheets. Plus, they're just really nice. Great high-quality bedding without that obscene high-quality price. Go and see for yourself. Go to trymiracle.com/politicsgirl to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you go today, you can save over 40% off. And if you use our promo code politicsgirl at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep today with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/politicsgirl and use the code politicsgirl to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/politicsgirl to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring the Politics Girl podcast. Support from today's episode comes from OneSkin. Did you know it's important to shift your skincare routine with the seasons? Things like dry, flaky skin, redness, even fine lines and wrinkles are a reflection of what's happening at the cellular level. So give your skin the TLC it needs to stay healthy, smooth, and hydrated as we move into the warmer weather. Founded by 4 PhDs dedicated to skin longevity, OneSkin proves you don't need a complicated routine to achieve better skin. Their topical supplements make it easy to help your skin stay younger and healthier without a lot of extra steps. OneSkin's products are powered by their scientifically proven peptide called OS1. This peptide reduces the accumulation of damaged, aging cells, the cells that make your skin less resilient and more prone to lines and wrinkles. Instead of masking these issues, OneSkin addresses them at the cellular level, boosting your skin's natural barrier to lock in moisture and help protect against the elements. They have a full line of face and body products, including OS1 Shield, an SPF that prevents UV-induced aging and repairs cellular aging all at once. That's the next product that I'm going to get. I've been using their eye cream for a couple of months now. I like the texture and how quickly it absorbs. I love that OneSkin believes the purpose of skincare is not just to improve how we look, but to optimize our skin biology so that it's more resilient to the aging process, and that is next level skincare. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on the cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. So get started today with 15% off using the code politicsgirl at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with the code politicsgirl. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support the show and tell them we sent you. New year, healthier skin. That's OneSkin. One of the things that resonated with me that you said in the Times Next Generation Leaders video, and congratulations, by the way, on that honor, is when you expressed how much responsibility some people feel to do it all, right? Like they're like, I see this problem and I want to fix it. And like the people that are passionate about me, I'm passionate about democracy, you're passionate about environmentalism, the people that are passionate about these things, we put everything we can into it because we can see how big the problem is. And then there's this massive burnout. You know, there's massive burnout of youth climate activism. And I when you were saying that, I was like, oh, I feel that in my bones. Like trying to stay positive and hopeful when the problem is so big and there's so many, you come up against so many people who would prefer to ignore the problem or act like the problem doesn't exist at all, it's demoralizing when you really recognize what's going on. And that can burn you out because you think, what am I doing? And it's just important, and you keep pointing this out, that young activists particularly and young climate activists get more support from older generations, that we need more intergenerational collaboration. As you've said, if the kids have all the energy and they're building all this stuff, then the older generations have all the money and the exposure and the media. We need them to collaborate, right? And I feel exactly the same way about democracy. We need way more intergenerational collaboration because there's just too much at stake to go it alone.
That's why I've kind of decided to go a different route from, I think, the traditional model of climate activism, which is, you know, you're doing a lot of protest organizing and sign waving. And don't get me wrong, I've done that. I have friends who do it. It's just not my main focus. But like protest organizing, sign waving, and you're either like going to the US government or maybe your state government or the UN. And you're like, please legislate on climate. I think I am excited about the organization that we're building with Sustainable and Just Future because I'm kind of more interested in like getting people green jobs and creating new green jobs. And you know what we're doing is like introducing people to this framework for how we can make the world a better place.
Okay, I'm just going to tell people just so they know. You launched Sustainable and Just Future. It's a nonprofit, right? Right. And it was sort of based on your original course that you were going to maybe bring to other universities. And now it's building out from there. You want to just back us up and tell us what you're doing with that? Because I think what you're doing with Sustainable and Just Future is so important. But people need to know it's now not just a college course. It's a non-for-profit.
Right. Okay. So I started teaching while I was an undergraduate at Berkeley. And I was a solution I designed myself. It's called Solutions for a Sustainable and Just Future. It was a course I taught by myself. And now it's like a massive thing. And we put thousands of people through that program. It's like broke records for largest ever. And it was because it was offering this really unique solutions oriented lens that people just were looking for. And we still have the most amazing testimonials coming out of that course where people are saying like, I did not feel hopeful coming into this. I didn't even understand climate change. And I didn't realize that I didn't understand climate change. But now that I do, I'm like, wow. And now I just feel like so hopeful. I feel like empowered. I feel like I have the tools I need to make a difference. And so we're trying to get young people who, I think the university level is really important to me because it's people who are just about to move into the workforce. So it's like immediate return on investment. Yeah.
No, it all comes back to economics, doesn't it? Yeah.
Right. Not to be a finance bro about it, but I just think that's a little more impactful than working with like eighth graders, right? So getting people like this framework and then how do you plug this into whatever career you're about to go in? How do you start to transform that for it to be circular? Or maybe it's like a new industry that has to grow, those sorts of things. How do we incorporate global sustainability and not just like, well, this product has a 70% lower carbon footprint. Like, how do you actually look at like materiality and supply chain ethics and things like that? So this is like this whole program. And so now we're moving into more universities as a nonprofit because I feel very passionate about this.
You're teaching people about stuff like decarbonization and community power and food systems and sustainable development, but also like environmental justice and like you're saying, post-growth, like maybe limiting the growth, this endless growth of the economy, maybe is not the best way to do it. And if you are someone that's coming out of college and you're about to start your job, you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're going to be a banker, you're going to be whatever, you might have in your head, okay, well, maybe we should be more circular economy. We should be more using what we already have. And that will be how I build my new business, how I build my new career. And I think that's a really smart way of teaching people, especially like you said, to people that are really about to join the workforce and reimagine it. Because I do think that your generation and younger is like, yo, you guys broke it and we're not going to continue on this path.
Yes, I think the youth burnout thing is like, I'm trying to divest from that model. I'm trying to divest from giving young people the idea that the only thing they can do is like lobby. So I think giving people the tools they need to feel like they can go out into the workforce and create change or to start their own initiatives or whatever it is this, you know, this is my version of climate activism. And I do other things as well. Like I'm involved in some campaigns and also, you know, public speaking is
you're doing
is
an a lot of public
thing.
Speaking.
Well, the public speaking is an interesting thing because it's like you're on stage and you get to, you know, you get 10 minutes, maybe 20, to quite literally scold and yell at some of the world's most powerful people. And then afterwards, like you're there, you're at the event, right? So then you go to dinner and you're seated across from a billionaire. And so, you know, so then we're like, let's have the hard conversation. So it's really interesting. And I've made a lot of like strange friends, I would say acquaintances, where like I'm now talking on a regular basis with people from the world's major banks or like the tech industry and stuff. And I think some people would be like, oh, like you're a traitor. And I'm like, no.
I'm just curious. I don't think you're a traitor at all. Are they listening to you? Are they listening?
I think to some extent. And I think they expect me to come like full teeth out, like scary, like I hate you. And I'm a friendly person in general. And so I try to like, you know, I'm sat down from someone at dinner and then we're doing introductions and it turns out they're a literal billionaire. And so I try to like see where they're at. And then they'll tell me about the things that they are doing that they think make the world a better place. They're like, well, I have my foundation and we donate. And I'm like, that's awesome. But so when you're a billionaire or you're a Fortune 500 executive, C-suite, whatever it is, there's a lot of people who want to tell you what to do and they have no reason to listen to you. So you actually do need to like build trust and build your own credibility with them and like give them a reason to believe that you are right, like someone worth listening to if you actually want to get something done, because yelling at them isn't necessarily going to work. It works on stage. But when you're having that person-to-person conversation, like you actually have to see them as a person,
yeah,
which can be hard when you're like, I know you, I know what you've done.
It is hard. No, I'm having Rutger Bregman on the show coming up because he was there at Davos being like, I don't know why we're sitting here with everyone that just flew in on their planes. And
he was so OG for that.
He's so amazing. And I'm having him on the show next month because I want to talk about, you know, he's looking at the world in a different way too. And he just sat there on the stage at Davos with all the richest people in the world. And he was like, why are we talking about your foundations and your philanthropy when we need to be talking about taxing you guys and changing your lifestyles so that the rest of us can keep living? And they were all like, whoa, like everyone's face on the stage was like, oh Lord. And I loved it because it was calling it out right in the moment at the heart of power. And I think that's also what you're doing. And obviously your work has a tremendous impact on a lot of people. And you have, you know, I think you've rightly said that you've built this framework of what a better world can look like, and you've put something into motion that now can't be stopped. There's enough people now that know these other options. So how do we give your, what you're doing more momentum? How do we help you succeed in what you're trying to do? Because ultimately what you're trying to do will only help us all. Please tell people how they can follow your work and anything that you might want to leave us with so we can be scolded, but in a useful way.
Well, I am on socials and I'm trying to build out my content creation so that I can like, you know, have that person-to-person audience where people can actually just come and learn solutions rather than hearing me say, oh, I've got this framework of all these solutions. I think people are like, okay, so what are they? So I'm like, all right. Like I'm working on the content creation and the speeches and whatnot to make sure that
And what are those socials that we can follow you on?
So just Sage Lanier, SageLenier on all platforms. Well, I basically Instagram and TikTok. I don't really use anything else. If you are, you know, someone who's associated with a university and you're interested in seeing this implemented in your school, what I'm trying to do right now at this very early stage of my career is solve our first problem, which is that we can't solve problems we don't understand. So that's why I'm latching onto this environmental education piece. And I'd love to see it institutionalized in every place possible. I'd love to see mandates at the K-12 level, at the university level. You should not have to get a college degree to learn about the environment. That's crazy. And that's like me just trying to solve our first problem. You know, then I'm going to jump ship. Once I feel like I've made good momentum on that, I'm going to jump ship and I'm going to be like, all right, how do we start solving problems? But
yeah,
I'll probably end up in, I don't know, climate finance or impact investing or something like that. I have no idea.
No, but what you're doing is, it's like, I've said it the same thing for what I do. It's like, Once you know, you care. And once you know, you can't unknow. And that's the thing. You start with knowledge. And once the wool's off people's eyes, they can't put it back on. And that changes their behaviors. It changes how they move through the world. It changes what they listen to. It changes how they hear a story on the radio or on television, because they're seeing it through the lens of knowledge and it doesn't just wash over them. And I think knowledge is the most important part, you know?
I think knowledge is I always try to say this, education is half the work. We actually have to, you can hear me and you can know that, okay, I'm hearing you, the Western world, we have to drastically change our lifestyles. Okay, now we can do it. We have to challenge our consumption. We have to challenge the culture that we have around ourselves of consumption. And we have to build more circular and localized systems that divest from these massive corporate conglomerates. You do with that whatever you will, right? Whatever direction you want to take that, however you feel most passionately about that. But you can't listen to this kind of thing and be like, oh, wow, well, someone else is going to handle it. Because the message is that, especially us in the global north, we actually have all the responsibility and all the power to transform the system. The billionaires aren't going to fix it because they created the system. It's the way they like it, right? And politicians are proving themselves to be much the same because they're besties. So the next largest group of people holding power is the masses of the global north. And so we actually have to come to the table and challenge our culture, our consumption, the way we build things, etc. So I hope that leaves people with something productive. I would love to have a book deal this year. And I just keep saying that to everybody so that somebody eventually finds me a book deal. So if you're listening, but I would love to be able to write a framework that is accessible to the average person, because honestly, we just don't have, we don't have our prisons obsolete of the climate movement. We just don't have environmental manuals that people are this is where I learned the thing. And so we've had this national conversation about anti-racism. I honestly don't think we've had it to the same extent about feminism, but it's somewhat there. And obviously there's still so much trouble with those issues, don't get me wrong, but I think it's time for it to be an all-encompassing conversation, including all the social issues. But it needs to be an environmental conversation where it's everyone on TikTok is reading this book and we're all talking about these topics, because we're not going to get things done unless people learn what the solutions are and how we get there.
I totally get you. I've got my first book coming out in September, and I worked so hard just to lay out how American government works and why it got broken and how we can fix it, because no one's written that book yet. And so I totally understand. And let's get you a book deal. I think that's essential.
I'm excited to read yours.
Yeah, well, it'll be good. It's called A Return to Common Sense, and it comes out September 17th. It's my first one. I'm very excited. But listen, I want to thank you for joining us today, Sage. As it says on the wall of one of your offices, every moment is an organizing opportunity. Every person is a potential activist. Every minute, a chance to change the world. And we obviously simply need more collaboration. And I saw that in one of your videos and I thought, yep, this girl gets it. And obviously her organization gets it too. So we need to support a sustainable and just future. And we need to support it, not just the organization, but a sustainable and just future for all of us.
Period. That quote on that wall is at the Student Environmental Research Center at Berkeley. And I love them so much. Shout out, CERC. You guys are my heart.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that was Sage Linear, reminding us that we can't solve problems we don't understand. At the end of the day, we need to accept that what we're doing here is unsustainable, that we will ultimately need to slow down the systems of production and look at an economic transformation from a linear economy to more of a circular economy. But we can start that from our local community level instead of just waiting for the federal government to make all the change. We need intergenerational collaboration and personal will to push through changes that the billionaires and a lot of the politicians won't want. But we can still feel hopeful and empowered as long as we give people the tools they need. I want to thank Sage for joining us today and you for caring enough about the planet to be here. Now go check out sustainableandjustfuture.org or Sage's socials and find out how to start using those tools today. Until next week, PG out. The Politics Girl podcast is written and performed by me, Lee McGowan, in partnership with the Midas Media Network, and produced and edited by Happy Warrior Entertainment. All rights reserved.